Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as my guest Teresa Merck. Teresa is 67 years old, originally from the Youngstown area, and she grew up there. She's been a registered nurse for 44 years. She has lived in Ohio, Germany, Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Illinois. She met her husband, Andy Merck, Sr. in 1985. They have been together for 40 years and married for 35. Been living in Bolivar, Ohio for 23 years. They had their first son in 1995. Teresa was 37 when she had Andy Jr. He was and still is the light of her and her husband's life. When Teresa was 42, God blessed her with another little boy named Joshua David Merck. Teresa and her family are huge sports fans. And Teresa dedicates her life to being of service to those going through life challenges as a result of her own life-altering tragedy, which we'll be talking about in detail during this podcast. Teresa, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on the program today.
Well, thank you, Dave. I've been looking forward to this. I want to start to dedicate some of my time. I only work part-time when I want to, so in the next couple of years, I want to expand, you know, not necessarily my viewership, but my support. And I want to lend support to a group of people that has been completely forgotten about. And we'll talk about that.
You got it. First of all, before we begin, got to give a shout out to Portia Booker. Portia introduced us. She thought your story would be a good fit and would align with the mission of my podcast. And we came to find out that it truly did, because we had a lot in common in terms of the life-altering tragedies that have gravitated us to a life of service. Portia's great. I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge her efforts to bring together good people. She's all about community, and she's all about building and fostering supportive, compassionate communities.
Yeah, and she, as I told you earlier, she's been a part of my family for over 10 years. She went to Kent State University, and my older son Andy and her became friends, and that was it.
Yep.
We've been friends with her ever since, and she was part of our story with my son's tragedy, my son Josh, and she was also a good part of our story because she officiated at my son's wedding, Andy, and his new wife, Abby, last year on December 14th. So you didn't know that.
No,
yes, she was amazing. Yeah. So adding to her list of accomplishments, now she is an ordained minister. So, yes.
That doesn't surprise me.
No, too. I know. It didn't surprise me either. No. Nope.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Anything she puts her mind to, and she does it with her heart and 100% effort. So.
Or we love you, Portia.
Yes, we love you, Portia. And so my first question for you, Teresa, is tell our audience about the experience or experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I've had a lot of experiences as a nurse for 44 years. You know, I'm 67 years old, so there have been a lot of things that have shaped my childhood. Some things I didn't tell you was I was raised a Catholic. I still pray, and that's actually part of my journey right now, and I've been struggling with my relationship with God, and that's been a struggle for me. I'm not an active Catholic. I don't really believe a lot of the things that they believe right now, but it hasn't reflected. It has not affected my relationship with our Lord and with God. But when something like this happens, you don't know how to feel. You know, like, why did he pick my son, Josh, to become ill? Why couldn't it have been somebody that was an evil person or less deserving? Why was it a good person? And so I have to think about that when I think about a podcast like this, or when I think about helping people that have been through a suicide, like my son committed, which we'll talk about. And I actually teach nurse aid students right now, not nursing, nurse aid students, certified nurse aides that work in nursing homes. And I actually use it as part of my teaching because I'm with them for 2 weeks and I want them to know what I've been through. It seems to me like a lot of the young people today are dealing with this stuff, abuse. I'm telling you, I usually have girls, a few guys occasionally, young 20s, early 30s. More than half of them in every class that I have been abused or have been, you know, some sort of abuse or alcoholism or substance abuse. And man, I just can't believe it. And so that's another reason that I thought I really need to advocate for mental health awareness. So my experience with my son, Josh, especially has brought me to that point. And I've done all sorts of nursing, but especially now, my son had a transplant. And I feel like those people have been forgotten. You know, I don't ever hear anybody talking about what people that had had kidney or liver transplants have gone through, about how sick they've been. And I did mention that in my remarks to you. But all of those things have shaped, you know, what I am today and what I hope to keep doing today. So.
And first of all, let me express publicly my condolences for the loss of your son. As somebody who had a daughter, and I call it transition from the physical body to the spiritual world over 22 years ago, I can understand the pain of losing a child. Certainly, our children's causes of death were different, which presents its own unique circumstances. However, the pain of losing a child is universal.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it doesn't matter how, when, where. Unfortunately, our experiences have brought us together.
And our experiences, at least for me, have motivated me to be of service in a lot of different ways to those individuals who are grieving and to the students that I teach. So the other thing you mentioned was about a crisis of faith after Josh passed. I had a crisis of faith, too. I mean, I was angry at God for quite a while after my daughter's passing, asking questions about why me, why my family, why did you pick us, why did you choose us? And I kept asking those questions until I realized that the only answer I was ever going to be satisfied with was with God coming down and saying, look, we made a mistake, we're going to give your life back. And once I knew that wasn't going to happen, I began to get clarity and began to take steps to reengage in life with purpose. But it's a process. And there's going to be, for those who are going to be watching the YouTube version, you're going to see pictures of Josh in the podcast, and he's a handsome young man. I like to ask my guest contributors who have lost somebody very near and dear to their hearts for us and my audience to get to know them through your eyes. So with that, tell us about Josh. Tell us what you love about him, what you want the audience to remember most about him.
His smile speaks for itself. He was such a happy baby. Blonde hair, blue eye, full of energy. Just about the best little boy you could possibly ever want. Never got in trouble once. Didn't really fight with his brother very much. Two boys, that's all we had. They were not too close in age. 5 years different. But he was just the perfect child. Not that Annie wasn't. When you're a new parent, you're getting to know things, and hopefully by the second one, you feel better, which I did. Being older, too, I was worried I wasn't going to have patience, but I did. That one really came pretty naturally. Thank God I have a wonderful partner and husband. He's been the rock of our family. But back to Josh, he very smart in kindergarten, grade school. He was in advanced math classes all through grade school and middle school. He was able to participate. I don't know what you guys call it out where you're located, but we in Ohio, we call it College Credit Plus. And he was taking those classes when he was already a junior in high school. And you take college classes and then you get credit for it, you know. So he was already doing that. The other part of him was an amazing athlete, just from 6 years old all through high school, football and baseball, a little wrestling, a little basketball, but his favorite was football. And then he wasn't as good of a baseball player, but he loved playing. So he did that all through school. And I mean, Josh just, he listened to his coaches. Everyone was always so impressed, you know, how he listened and what a great kid he was. He was kind to everybody. Kindness, like, I can't even tell you. When he was 8 years old, we have a neighbor that has an autistic child, and they were the same age. And they happened to be in the same classes in grade school. And he would come home and say to me, "Mommy, why are they mean to Logan? Like, I don't understand." You know, he yells sometimes, but he can't help it. And he wanted to know what was wrong with him at 8 years old. And I said to him, his brain is wired different than everybody else's. You know, that's all that's wrong with him. He's just a little different. And he said, "Oh, okay." And from that moment on, when other kids would make fun of his friend and neighbor, Josh would stick up for him, even at 8 years old. So right from the beginning, he was just such a kind kid, curious about everything. That was just the biggest thing. Smiling. He loved life. He was a good friend to everybody. Just absolutely loved life. Until he got sick when he was a junior. So did you want me to talk about that now or?
You can. Yes, you can. You just go wherever you want to go.
Okay. It was in 2018. He was going to graduate high school in 2019, which he did. But beginning of 2018, for the first 2-3 months, the kid was never sick. I mean, the most he had done was he had maybe one or two cavities. And this was when he was a junior in high school. And occasionally he would get a sinus infection called things kids get, stomach flu and that, but he never was really, really sick. And that didn't even happen very often. He was just a real healthy child. So when he started getting all these things, started out with headaches, and then we thought he had sinus infections and ear infections and strep throat and even pneumonia once or twice. This was not normal for him. So we took him to his pediatrician. He was still seeing a pediatrician at 17. I didn't feel the need to switch him to an adult doctor because this guy knew him when he was a little kid. Mm-hmm. So I figured I was safe as a nurse to stay with him until he kind of kicked us out. So this doctor knew him very well. And he would give me antibiotics and they wouldn't work. And of course, I'd take him again and it still wouldn't work. And of course, this always happened on weekends when your doctor isn't in. So I would take him to the 2, 3, 4 different hospitals around here, to the ER, to urgent or stat cares. They would treat him, you know, antibiotics, antibiotics, antibiotics. Well, everything would come back. Everything kept coming back and he kept getting worse. So in April of 2018, he was a junior in high school, almost finished with that year, getting really good grades. He was in an engineering program at our local Kent State University campus. And so he was going there for he wanted to be an engineer, like my husband. And he was working on this project, and we thought he was just tired from doing school and baseball and working on this project, plus his other classes. I think he had one other college class at the time. Well, things were getting worse. He started to look pale. And of course it had to be that last week where he had to turn in that engineering project, right? And so I was out of town for work for 2 weeks and I get a call from my husband and saying, "Josh is really sick. There's something wrong with him. He doesn't feel good. He's limping. He was very pale." And the day before I came home, his skin turned yellow. He was jaundiced, but he didn't want to go anywhere. He was stubborn. He had to get that engineering project done. So the night he had it finished, this was in middle of April, end of April. I think it was after Easter. And I called him and talked to him and I said, "Josh, we have to take you to the hospital. You're too sick." He goes, "Yeah, Mom, but I got to get this done." So I was still out of town. My husband went with him. I was only about an hour and a half from home. My husband went with him, got an A, did great, got first place on their engineering project. Project Lead the Way. The program is all over the country for high school students that want to be engineers. I called him and I'm like, "You meet me at home." Came home, dropped all my stuff off. I'd been gone for 2 weeks. Directly took him to our local hospital in Canton. We were there probably an hour. The young doctor came in and said, "I can't treat him here. I don't know what's wrong with him." he was essentially in renal failure at the time. They thought he had pneumonia. They thought he had a sinus infection, but they had no idea where all this was coming from. His blood work was, white blood cells were out the roof. His kidney numbers were horrible. It was almost like he was trying septic because he had been in renal failure for a while. And of course, that's where the jaundice was from. So immediately we went, we have an amazing hospital in Akron, Ohio called Akron Children's. We're lucky to have three hospitals like that in Ohio, Akron, Columbus, Nationwide, and there's also Rainbow Hospital in Cleveland. So, and when we got there, they weren't sure at first. They admitted him to just a regular room, but overnight he was having trouble breathing. So they had to intubate him. He was going into respiratory failure. And during the workup, the one doctor actually came in that night. She was a rheumatologist. And what he ended up having was an autoimmune disease, very extremely rare. Only 1 in 2 million teens get it, and 1 in 1.5 million adults get it, called Wegener's disease or granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Essentially, it is called a vasculitis, which is an inflammation of the inside of your blood vessels. And his red and white blood cells were fighting against each other. At first, they thought he had leukemia. But with leukemia, you don't always have renal failure. So they cut that out. Then they weren't sure. It might have been AIDS, which is very similar. And we also have lupus on my side of the family and my husband's. So they knew it was some kind of autoimmune disease. But luckily that evening that I took him in, there was a young rheumatologist who had seen the disease and had treated it. Thank God. If we had gone anywhere else in Ohio, we wouldn't have found this young lady. And thank God she was there because she knew what to do. And it took a few days. They had to confirm the diagnosis. And the only way to do that was to get a kidney biopsy, which unfortunately hospitals on the weekend, I'm afraid it's going to get worse. Sometimes they don't have the facilities or people to do a biopsy on a Sunday or a Saturday. Mm-hmm. So we had to wait till Monday morning. And that was horrible because he was in ICU and he was off and on a ventilator, but there was nothing they could do. The treatment was very specific and very damaging. And if it wasn't that, it might have caused other side effects, and they had to be sure. So Monday morning, they did it. They found out. But they did, prior to that, start him on a high dose of steroids, which is one of the things you do for autoimmune diseases. Mm-hmm. And the other thing they were able to do was they had to start him on dialysis. They had no choice. Otherwise, he would have died. His body was toxic because it wasn't being flushed out through his kidneys, the toxins. So they did find out what was wrong, and then after the diagnosis, he was still intubated, but they were able to start him on a treatment. The first thing they did, which I think helped more than anything, was a procedure called plasmapheresis, where the first thing they do is they take all the blood out of your body, and they separate the plasma. It's in the machine at the bedside, and they try and purify it. And dialysis does that too, but this is even an extra step that they do just with your blood. So they did that couple times, and what they did was a plasma exchange, which they took his old plasma off and gave him a donor plasma, and that seemed to do the trick. The other ones helped, but not that much. And then he was also started on a regimen of oral autoimmune disease medicine. It's a chemotherapy medicine. It's called rituximab, and a lot of people get it for cancer and other autoimmune diseases. And it decreases the inflammation in your cells. And so that whole combination worked. It worked. Mm-hmm. It did not take away his kidney failure, obviously. Your kidneys don't just bounce back. But he was in Akron Children's for 3 months. I only left him twice. My husband, we weren't very far from Akron, only 40 minutes. So it wasn't a super long drive, but long enough. My husband was in the middle of a project at work. He had to finish it. So he would be all day at work, come up there, then come home, get up, go to work. He did that for 3 months. I honestly don't know how he did it. I was like, he's a super guy. He's Superman, I'm telling you. So, and luckily, too, my older son, Andy, was still home. He had graduated from college like a year before that, but hadn't been able to find a job. And he had a job offer, but he turned it down to stay home. Mm-hmm. It was like God put things in the right place at the right time. The other thing that happened was he did come home. The medication kind of masked his kidney disease, and they were working, not great, but enough that he didn't have to be on dialysis. that summer when he came home. And the school, and especially his football team, they were amazing. They prayed for him all the time. They came to visit him. I mean, we had visitors every day at that hospital, amazing people around here. Plus my family from Youngstown came, and my husband's family's from Pittsburgh. So they came. I mean, you know, we just had a ton of support. But then he was able to come home for that summer, but he had to walk. I don't know if you know anyone that's ever been on dialysis or had kidney failure. Diet and fluid balance are the key to them staying alive.
Mm-hmm.
Plus a ton of meds. He's an 18-year-old kid. He was an athlete. Can't have ice cream. He can't have milk. He has to watch his water intake. And as an athlete, you do just the opposite. You eat a lot of protein. Yep. You eat dairy. You drink. You stay hydrated. All that changed for him, just like this. His life changed overnight. The other thing that happened, which I forgot to mention, because of the treatment, the plasmapheresis and all the other medicines and stuff, he ended up getting blood clots in his carotid and also mm-hmm. in his jugular.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, he wasn't allowed to play sports because they were too afraid that it would break off and kill him. Because otherwise he was doing well until that summer, until he started up his senior year of high school. About 2 months in, he got really sick again and he needed to go on dialysis. But in that time frame, he had been dating a girl for 4 years in high school at that point. And she was a year older than him, and she was going to the University of Akron. So he was able to go see her, go up there and stay with her, and felt like he had a life rather than just being sick all the time, which was really good for him, I thought, at the time. In October, he had gone to visit her, and then he took her to a movie and took her back to Akron. On the way home, he didn't realize how sick he was, and he almost died. He rolled his car over. He fell asleep. And he didn't drink or anything. All he did was take the meds. He didn't take pain medicine. There was no substances except for the medicines that were keeping him alive. Mm-hmm. And he found out that his kidneys had completely failed and he needed to go on dialysis at home. So that was the second miracle. Akron Children saved his life. God saved his life because he didn't die in that accident. And then the third one was, so this was in 2018 into 2019. He was a senior in high school. Like I said, he couldn't do sports, and that really killed him more than school or anything. He would have been in his senior year in football, amazing football player, athlete, 10 years, and he mm-hmm. didn't get to play a senior year in high school. I don't know if you know kids that are athletes, but can you imagine how that would have just broken them, mm-hmm. just broken them? And it did, you know, that finally, because when he was in Akron Children's, the thing that I love about children's hospitals especially is they really take care, or they try and take care of the young person's mental health.
Mm-hmm.
There were counselors in there every day. They had child life specialists, and they loved him because he was a teenager. And normally they don't have teenagers in children's hospital. They have little kids that don't talk to them. So they absolutely loved him. The nurses would come hang out in his room. We were like the social area of the floor. They loved him. And the other thing they do is they also give mental health and psychological support to the parents, and they're separate from the kids.
Yep.
So when he became an adult in the hospital, they didn't do that at all. So he got through his senior year in high school. He was able to graduate. We had a lot of community support. His girlfriend was amazing. I think that had it not been for her, he might have lost the will to live at that point. And I bring this up because they were just inseparable, and they had never had boyfriends or girlfriends. They were like each other's first love, and they hardly ever fought, and until the mental illness started to seep in. Mm-hmm. And then things changed, but that was until after he graduated from high school. So he graduated from high school in 2019 in May. So during that time frame, now when he was 17, being at Akron Children's, he could have gone on the transplant list, okay, but he would have been last on the list, being an older child rather than a two-year-old that needed a kidney transplant. So that was difficult for us to navigate. Once we knew he was going to be 18, Akron Children's got us in touch with the transplant department at Cleveland Clinic. So we did preliminary stuff. Once we knew he was going to be 18, then he could get on the adult UNOS list. Well, guess what? We didn't have to wait that long. And the reason was because he was 18. And not only that, my son and my husband and I were all a match for him. All of us. That never happens, Dave. It doesn't happen.
No, No.
Especially because that disease he had was so rare. Here was the other thing. We had lupus on both sides of the family. My mom and my sister had it, and my husband's sister and cousins had it. And because of all that, it made it even more rare that we were a match. So in order to be eligible to be a donor, you have to go through rigorous physical testing and stuff. So my husband's like, well, you go first, okay? You're his mom. If you can give him a kidney, we'll let you do it. Well, I went first, but unfortunately, unbeknownst to me, even being a nurse, I'm a short person, and short people and older women have small kidneys. I did 2 days of testing for nothing, and the doctor's like, oh, you can't give him a kidney. You're too old. I'm like, geez, you could have told me that before, you know? Mm-hmm. But that was okay. There's still two more people. So then the next thing was my husband went and had all the same tests I had. And guess what? He was a match. A little bit younger than me. He was 58. And he was able to give Josh a kidney. And obviously saved his life. So that was our third miracle. And unfortunately, well, Josh was supposed to start in September at University of Akron. He got accepted like a year before that because we applied for early. And he got a $35,000 scholarship. And that was the only place he applied. So it was amazing. And it was great because of what we had been through. It was so nice to have something positive, such positive news, the transplant and then that. But he wasn't able to start as a freshman that year because of the transplant. He wasn't allowed to be around other people for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because his immune system was non-existent. And he couldn't be around people in a classroom or in a dorm just because it could have killed him, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In January of 2020, he started with his college credit process. Would have been at the end of his freshman year. So he started, he was able to go to in-person classes for only 2 months. Because you know what happened in March of 2020? COVID hit. And they closed all the universities down. They had to do online classes. Now, his girlfriend lived up there, but she lived by herself. And she worked at Arby's, and she had to wear head-to-toe coverage just to go and mm-hmm. work. So it was a perfect scenario because he couldn't be around other people. We didn't go anywhere because nothing was open, but there was online classes. So they were still able to take online classes, and he can go visit her because she lived by herself. So that was at least one outlet for him, but that wasn't all the time. He didn't want to be up there all the time. So essentially he did his first 2 years of college engineering in his bedroom, which we found out later was the worst thing that could have happened. Because that's when the depression set in. He had been for years a big video gamer. That kept him some sanity. But as the years went on and COVID went away, he was spending more and more time in his room. Now, when we were stuck here during COVID, he didn't stay up there all the time. He stayed up there a lot of the time, but we would play games and have dinner, you know. And physically, he was doing well with the transplant, mm-hmm. even with all the meds, the diet restrictions went mm-hmm. away. But he still had a lot of meds to take, and he had to go do blood work, and he was very faithful with all that. During that first year, 20 and 21 and 22, he had been getting worse, depression. I also believe he had PTSD, you know, from being close to death so many times and dialysis and everything. He wasn't a normal kid. His life was completely different. And I mean, that's hard enough for us as an older person, as adults, to deal with, let alone someone that age.
Well, and he also went through a lot of medical trauma, too, as far as, you know, hospital visits and antibiotic therapy and dialysis. And he survived, like you said, there were three miracles for him. So being that close to death, I would imagine if I was a 19-year-old, that would cause some trauma with me as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I talked to him all the time. You know, how are you doing? And early on when he had first gotten sick, he had said to me, Mom, I have this funny feeling that I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to be around. But this was before his transplant. So I understood, you know, he was scared. He was unsure. He didn't know if he was going to live. So that's what I attributed it to. But now that I think about it, you know, that might have been the beginning of the depression and anxiety and everything that goes along with it.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is I think young adults and children have a sense of their own mortality. Sometimes they get glimpses into it. I discovered after my daughter's transition that 2 years before she was diagnosed, she downloaded a poem. It was a variation of When Tomorrow Starts Without Me.
Yeah.
you know, saying, you know, one of the messages was that understand that I wanted to stay, but I couldn't, I had to go. And I think she knew. I mean, I can't speak for you or Josh's experience, but there's a lot of young adults that have kind of had that, that kind of premonition or that feeling that, you know, their stay on this earth was going to be a short one. It was going to be an impactful one, but it was going to be a short one.
Yeah, that's kind of the feeling I got too, you know, because after it happened, I'm like, wow, he said that to me.
Yeah.
And he never said it to anybody else. It was just to me. And it was just on a day, like in the summer, we were sitting here at home watching TV. And I went up to give him a hug, ask him how he was doing. You know, I asked him that every single day. And so did my husband. And he always said he was okay. You know, and at the time he was. But in 2022, right, it would have been probably right after they started back with school. I think it was like a year and a half of staying at home. And then they opened the campus up again. And so he was schooling, spending a lot of time with his girlfriend up there. Things changed drastically. Just probably it had been coming on, but he didn't notice it. He started having a lot of difficulty in school, like brain fog, couldn't focus. He was never, ever like that, ever. And unbeknownst to us, he wasn't doing well in school. He never told us. I didn't find out till later. But when I look back on it, the college had already known because he had, you know, gotten a reprieve from his first semester. You know, when you go to state university, you have to live there. But he, you know, didn't have to live there because of his, you know, health. So mm-hmm. He was able to stay at home. So they already knew about his medical history. And so he had had his, and I have to say this, and I'm sorry if I'm doing it, because they were wonderful until they weren't. But it wasn't everybody's fault. I feel like he got lost in the system between the Cleveland Clinic and our family doctor. So he had his kidney transplant at the Cleveland Clinic. He was one of the youngest recipients ever. They loved him up there. He had a young, really wonderful young male nurse who was his case manager. And I shout out to him because he was just great with Josh. And they really kept an eye on him, or so I thought they did. Mm-hmm. But they do not have a dedicated psychological mental health program for people after transplants. Now, I don't know if things have changed. I called them twice. They never called me back. But I'm going to keep pursuing it. And, I mean, this isn't saying anything bad about the hospital. They save lives every day there. It's amazing. Like I say, we have amazing healthcare here in Ohio. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the people, especially the people on dialysis, they go through these emotions every single time they have dialysis. Are they going to come out and go to the hospital? Are they going to die the next day? I mean, this is just ongoing. And sometimes it's 10, 15 years that people are going through this.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't you think that when they have a transplant and they're better, they've been sick for so long and now they're better? They did not have a dedicated program. Well, when I told his nurse manager about it, and he had talked to Josh a few times about what was going on, they did get an appointment with a psychiatrist at Cleveland Clinic. She canceled the first one. He made another one. He went there. She talked to him for about 10 minutes. That was it. She put him on antidepressant. She didn't follow up with him, nothing. He called there numerous times. They never followed up. Well, by that point, the transplant meds had affected him intimacy-wise with his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't tell me this, and they ended up breaking up. Mm-hmm. And he hurt her pretty badly. He wasn't the type of kid that would have hurt her on purpose. Had it not been for his illness, I don't think any of that would have happened. He loved her. He wanted to spend the rest of his life with her, he told me. But he just couldn't function as a young man, and there were a lot of other things. The depression affected his hygiene. He couldn't focus. He wasn't himself at all. So then he started dating another girl. And after a couple months, she came to me and she said, he's really depressed. I know this because I've been there. And she said, I'm worried about him. But she had a little girl and they were close. And she said, I can't be around someone that's unstable because I love him and I care about him. And my little girl loves him, but I can't have her love him as a daddy when he is not, mm-hmm. he's not healthy mentally wise. So I gave her a lot of credit for that because she alerted us to it. So at that point, he did go with me to our family doctor, who is a male. And Josh never really did well with females. If I'm not explaining it, he just felt more comfortable with our doctor because he was a man. Mm-hmm. And I was in the room And he just poured his heart out for an hour, which I thought was something really good. What happened was, like a month or two later, Josh said to me, "Mom, I'm feeling really anxious and I don't feel like the medicine is working." So the doctor prescribed him a double dose of Lexapro. Now, being a nurse, you would have think that I would have known, well, the side effects. I did not. And I should have. And 6 months later is when he took his own life.
Boy, was that one of the side effects of Lexapro, Teresa, is suicidal ideation?
And the top one is the number one side effect. Yes.
And double the dose. And I'm thinking he wasn't himself after the kidney transplant, physically, emotionally, engagement-wise, which was totally antithesis of who he was before he became sick.
Yes.
And boy, that would have, for me, probably really put up a lot of red flags, knowing, you know, who he was before. And I would say, hey, what's going on? You know, you don't seem to be yourself. What's happening? What can we do to help? What can we do to support you through this time? Right. You know, and show some compassionate presence at that point. It sounds like there's a lot of people in the healthcare system that knew him because of his, knew who he was before he became sick, and then saw what he became after.
Well, you know, that's what I thought too, especially because he sat in that doctor's office and told him everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was supposed to start counseling, not only through Cleveland Clinic, but through our family doctor. And they sent him the information, and he never did it. But the doctor never followed up with him either.
Yeah.
Which I feel like he should have. And he was 18, and I, you know, at that point, 19, or maybe even 20, as a mom, I couldn't tell him what to do. Yep. You know, I could talk to him, I could explain to him, you know, you need to go to therapy. Oh, I'm okay. You know, but he was getting worse and worse. And the hole he was going in was even deeper. So after the second girl broke up with him, he kind of wasn't really that upset about it. But luckily at the time, he had a full-time job, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he loved what he did. And I really believe that that kept him above water enough to stay alive at that time. And so he went that whole summer and he met a girl online and they became friends. And they were kind of dating, but she lived far away. So we didn't see her that much. And they were just kind of young lovers, friends with benefits. He was more of a friend than a girlfriend to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that little time frame there that he realized that he shouldn't have never broken up with the first girl. He told me that she was his soulmate. And apparently she did feel the same way. But the problem was he hurt her really bad. And that, of course, weighed on him more than anything, I think. And she was with somebody else. So, but what we found out later was they had spent time together a couple of days before he died. He went to a concert with her because she didn't drive. And she asked him to go, knowing full well that they had, you know, Josh had a girlfriend, kind of, and she kind of had a boyfriend, but they were going as friends. Yeah. Well, Josh didn't see it that way. He thought it was a way to try and get back together with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me afterwards that the time they spent together, it was like 10, 12 hours. They had to travel a couple hours to this concert and stay there and then came home. That she had seen that he was completely different, almost back to his normal self, except mm-hmm. for the depression. But as far as how he was dealing with her, and she was going to ask him if they wanted to start dating again. Like a couple of days after he did it, she was going to call him and say, "I think we should start going out as friends first and maybe start dating again." And that was the hardest part because she couldn't say, "Oh, let's just get back together right now." And he was upset about that, you know, and he didn't tell his current girlfriend that he went to this concert as friends with this girl. So the night before he passed, she broke up with him on the internet, didn't even call him and talk to him. And I found out later through all the text messages, and he was on this thing called Discourse, which is a social media group that younger people use, and like gamers use it, apparently.
Yep.
And he had been saying things like he's hopeless. He hadn't been happy for 5 years. He told her he didn't want to live. And she knew about this, and they broke up. And she was not, I'm not going to say a well person, but she had been through a lot in her life. And so she took it really badly. And she knew all this. He had, in the text messages, he said he was going to end his life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, instead of calling us like that night, us or even the sheriff, somebody around, she'd been to our house. She knew where we lived. She didn't call anybody. She'd been mm-hmm. through a lot. She'd been traumatized and she didn't feel like she could do it. So the next day after she didn't hear from him, she called the Akron police. It was too late. He had already done it. And the last phone call he made was to his first girlfriend. But she was worried that she was giving him false hope and she didn't want to answer the phone and him think right away they're going to get back together. So I understood where she was coming from. Plus, she was at work and she couldn't pick the phone up. But that was the last person he called. And of course, you can imagine how she felt, like it was her mm-hmm. fault. She didn't answer the phone. And so it was just like the system failed him the whole way through. Now, I'm not blaming the Cleveland Clinic. I'm not blaming our doctor. But the first person I blamed was obviously myself. I was a caregiver. I should have seen the signs. But I still don't think, because there was no note, and except for those two text messages, which was just the night before he passed. And one other time, he was with his first girlfriend. But they were having a fight. And you know how I can remember being dating somebody and they were going to break up with me, and I would say, oh, I'm going to kill myself. This is an emotional reaction, but I didn't mean it. And he didn't mean it at the time either. But that was the only other time he had ever said anything like that to her. And they'd been together for almost 7 years, so she knew him better than anybody. If she would have seen that, she would have done something right away. But this girl didn't know Josh that well. And I just wish she had seen it, because even when they were together for those 12 hours, he never said anything to her. He was so happy to be with her. They were starting to trust each other again. And he knew it was going to be a long time because he really hurt her. And he knew it was his fault. But when we look back on it, all the things that were happening because of his mental illness. They were not him. He would have never cheated on her. He was just so confused. And his body wasn't, he was felt sick. And, you know, he couldn't perform as a man. And by the time he realized that she was the love of his life, it was almost too late. And he didn't see any way back. It was December 6th of 2023. I was starting to put up Christmas decorations. And I was going to wash my curtain, because that's what I do. He took my curtains down for me. And then he said he'd be back later in the day. One thing he loved to do, because he still liked to stay fit, because he had been an athlete for so long, he went to the climbing gym. That was one thing he was allowed to do after the transplant. And so he'd been going there for years. And they knew him real well there, and it was right on campus.
Yeah.
Well, instead of going over there, he went to the parking garage and took his own life with a handgun. He never made it to the climbing gym. And he had been fighting with that girl overnight and apparently crying. And I don't know how I didn't hear him, Gabe. How can you not hear your own son sobbing all night in the other room? I don't understand that. That still haunts me. Why did I not hear him? Mm-hmm. Probably because he didn't want me to, or his dad, mm-hmm. or his brother. But I don't think he had it planned. I think it was just, it happened overnight. And then he decided it was too much and he couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, I think for a lot of individuals who contemplate or complete suicide, it's just that they feel their situation's hopeless. There's no solution to their problems and they just feel overwhelmed and they just want to end their life. And a lot of the things that you talked about is feeling guilty about, gee, should I have seen the signs? Could I have done something more? I think those are some of the unique challenges that I talk to other parents whose children have died by suicide. And that's some of the unique challenges that they go through is, could I have seen the signs sooner? Could I have done? But obviously with Josh, everything you did for him was out of love. When somebody makes up their mind, they're going to die by suicide, they've usually got a plan and they don't tell anybody. Mm. And unless you had medium-like abilities and could see the future, there wasn't any way you could have even seen that. Or even, and I like to think we have confidence in our kids to solve their own problems, especially if we've laid the foundation for that. So, but the other thing is that a lot of parents and individuals who are survivors of a loved one who have died by suicide, they get these questions all the time by a society that wants answers, and there's no answers to a complex situation like this. And what it ends up doing is it isolates the parents more from a community who should be supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And those are some of the unique challenges. I don't know if you've experienced any of that yourself, but those are a lot of things that I've seen and I've heard from other parents whose children have died by suicide.
Well, honestly, not so much for my community. I mean, I live in a very small area. And of course, my husband already knew everybody because we had been involved in sports for 15 years and we knew everybody. And so, but here's the other challenge that I had. In November of 2023, it was November 14th. Where are you located?
I'm in upstate New York, Utica, New York area.
You might have heard about this then. Our local high school, Tuscarora Valley High School, our band was going on a charter bus to Columbus for a yearly band concert, and it was in November before Christmas.
Yeah.
And a semi-truck driver plowed through a car into the bus and into another bus, and six people died, three students and three teachers. And one of those teachers was my son's favorite math teacher. Yeah. So this was only 3 weeks before he took his own life. When I told him that day, he was up in his room, and I told him what happened. He didn't really cry or anything, but he had told his best friend who had been in class with him with this math teacher. His friend told me that Josh said, "Wow, Mr. Kennett died so quick. He didn't have any pain. I hope I go that way, you know, someday." Now, Billy said he didn't say he was going to do anything, but he thought it was odd that he would think about that. Instead of feeling sad that the guy died, he was sad that he died, but not the way he died, fast. So that's the only thing everybody I've talked to that he never said anything to anybody else. So that was the only clue we had that he might. But his friend didn't think anything of it. He agreed with him like, my God, he was young. He wasn't that young. He was in his 50s, but that's the way to go. You always say that, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're going to
mm-hmm.
die, you die fast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There was absolutely no pain. He was alive and he was gone that quick. This was all over the national news for weeks. It went on and it seemed like it didn't stop. And I'm wondering if that kind of planted the seed for him. Although he didn't have a plan, he had at least thought about it.
And there are some things we'll never know about the circumstances of death until we end up meeting our loved ones in the afterlife, which I believe will happen. But
oh, me too.
You know, I've read that in only 18% of the situations or cases where individuals have died by suicide has there even been a note left. So you're talking 82% of those individuals who died by suicide don't leave a note. So,
no, he didn't. The only way I kind of got an inkling of what was happening was through his friends. He was on a bunch of social media things, and we looked through his computer, and I looked through his phone, and that's kind of, I came up with all these things, you know, after putting everything together. But it took me a long time.
And that process is important, I think, to individuals whose children or loved ones have died by sudden death, whether it's suicide, homicide, accident, is the kind of retrace your steps and try to put some closure to the actual event. Mm-hmm. And try to get some understanding, and that's a natural part of the process. And I hope
I hope
that you and your family get some of the answers that you're longing for.
And actually, my husband hadn't wanted. He didn't. We did go. We're very lucky out here. Healthcare is amazing. Our county, we have a hospice inpatient facility, mm-hmm. and along with that, with the county health department, we have counselors that go there.
Mm-hmm.
Serve the families, the hospice patients, but the counselors also serve the entire county.
Mm-hmm.
So we were put in touch with, it was actually through the Akron Police Department, because they're the ones that found them. It was their case. They actually got us in touch with the counselors there, and I still see a grief counselor, and there's no charge to us, as long as we're tax-paying citizens of our county, yep. which is amazing. And why don't we have more of that in this country? Yeah. Every county has a health department. Pay some counselors, let them out in the community, and they service everybody. Veterans, substance abuse, those counselors, they have no boundaries. And hospice and families. So my husband did go for about 4 months, but then he's like, I don't have to go anymore. And that time frame during that first year was difficult for us. He was gone. He was engaged, going to get married. So we were here alone. We hadn't been alone for years.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, we have three dogs that kept us busy. But I was really worried about him in the beginning. But the other thing I've had, which I didn't mention to you, was I've had a lot of people, one in particular, my husband's from Pennsylvania, And his older brother lives out in Lancaster, PA. And one of his daughters married a guy who I found out was a psychic. And I didn't know this until after Josh passed. And he texted me out of the clear blue sky like 2 days after Josh died and said, Josh sent me a message and gave me details. Mm-hmm. I only met this kid one time. Josh met him one time when he was 2 years old. He didn't know anything about Josh. The things he told me, he would have never known. Never, you know, like about his death and other things. We didn't even tell everybody how he died at first. But he gave me specific details. So when our son's wedding was, we'd gotten a lot closer with them. They came to the funeral. We had been drifting away from my husband's family. We hadn't seen them in a few years. So it was good. It was horrible that we had to get together, but it was a good thing, you know? Yeah. So now we're close with them again. During my son's wedding, they came for the wedding, and his name's Richie. He was able to give my husband a reading that he would never have known about because I never talked about it. And Josh was worried about finances because we didn't realize out of the clear blue sky, my husband had one of those college savings accounts for Josh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of money in it. So Josh didn't have to really pay for school plus his scholarship. One day he came up to my husband and said, I want to start paying for my own classes because he was working full time and he had a good job. He was making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. My husband didn't understand why and I didn't either. We came mm-hmm. to find out later that he had had really bad grades those two semesters. Yep. That wasn't his fault, and he thought it was. You know, mm-hmm. it was brain fog. It was all the symptoms of depression, PTSD, you name it. Mm-hmm. He had it mm-hmm. all. We found out later. And they knew that he wasn't well. You know, we'd even had our family doctor sent the dean of that school saying, you know, that if he has difficulty, this is why. They mm-hmm. knew that he was struggling. And apparently advisors, mm-hmm. college advisors had talked to him mm-hmm. and they were letting him repeat classes because he assured them that he was getting the help that he needed. And even though he wasn't getting all the help he needed, he was living at home, it was stable. And so they let him repeat and he actually was able to bring some grades up. All designing in the business for kids to fail, yeah. with their, you know, that's what their job is. So they were wonderful to him. You know, and we just found out all this later. And so that whole thing about money that Josh was worried about, Richie said that to him, sitting right here in this office. There's no way Richie would have known about that. My husband told me after he died that he wondered why Josh wanted to pay for his own classes. I didn't know about it.
Yep. Good evidentiary mediums will give you information that's only known to the family. And a good medium in early grief can help an individual's families find comfort. A bad or a non-reputable medium can do more harm than good. So I'm glad you got that.
Yeah. And I mean, I have joined a group since after we met Richie. I have joined two survivors groups for women that do monthly Zoom meetings with mediums.
Good.
And they're free. They don't charge you anything unless you want to do private meetings with the mediums that you meet on this, but they do it every couple of weeks. And you should see there's thousands of people on those Zoom calls. They're amazing.
Yeah.
Thank God for them. You know, I know. And then a friend of mine that I met through all of this lived here. And I met her through one of my other friends. And we hooked up, and her and another lady and I had all been survivors of suicide for young kids. It was her granddaughter at 12 and the other lady, her son at 26 or 28. And so I met these two ladies. And since then, we have formed a group of survivors, and we have about 10,000 members now. This is only a year ago.
Wow.
Amazing.
Wow.
Called Kaylee's Legacy. And we've connected with women and men and parents and siblings all over the world. And I also joined two grief groups out here in Canton, where I live, in our county. So it's all led to really good things. So,
and through those groups, is that how you're creating awareness about the need for mental health resources for transplant recipients?
Yes, it is. Yes. And I was also on a podcast with Jennifer Rogers. I don't know if you know who she is.
I've been on her podcast too.
Yes.
She's great. Great. She's great.
She's wonderful. So, now that the wedding's over and my husband and I are having some health issues, we have our house remodel. So now that all that is finally done, now I can actually get back into what I wanted to do in the first place, you know.
Well,
health awareness for transplant patients. So,
and One of my last questions for you is, what are some of the resources that you think are important for transplant recipients to have regarding mental health that's maybe different from traditional mental health services?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the first thing you need to do, they need to find a support group, you know, at their hospital or their community. They're out there. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I'm worried about is I don't know that they're specific to patients and what they've gone through before transplant. You can join a lot of support groups, but are they going to be specific to your needs? I don't know. But talk to your doctors. Mm-hmm. One of my best friends in the whole world, her brother has been a nephrologist in Toledo, Ohio for 40 years. And he never really thought about that side of it. Mm-hmm. He told me that they do have specific groups for transplant people. Yeah. So we need to do a better job for mental health overall in this country. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that there's any special groups for that. Maybe I'll be the one to start that here. Yeah. For patients that had a transplant or families that have lost someone because they couldn't get a transplant.
Or experienced very debilitating mental health and physical health symptoms that contributed to a loss of interest in life and eventually suicide. So.
Yeah.
And I would see some of the unique challenges with transplant recipients about grieving, you know, about part of their body that they lost, grieving, you know, a part of their existence, like with Josh, who is an athlete, not being able to do that anymore. There's just so many different categories with that need to be addressed. So, and my last question for you, and thank you so much, first of all, for a great conversation and for sharing your heart and sharing your son. If individuals want to get in touch with you, you know, align with your movement to try to get more resources for mental health resources for individuals who've gone through transplants or are transplant recipients, what's the best way for them to do that, Teresa?
Well, I gave you my email, which I guess you will put online, and my cell phone number. The biggest one is K with Legacy, which I gave you the website for Messenger.
Yes.
And I gave you my address for my Facebook page.
Yep.
And that's pretty much it for right now. But just find some support groups. I am honestly surprised that more people have not committed suicide waiting for transplants. Because they're so sick and they're so tired of being sick. Someone has cancer, you're not going to get a cure. You know, there's no cure for cancer. And eventually, you know, it's going to take your life. Okay. With transplants, there's no beginning and there's no end. They're in limbo. They don't know.
Yep.
Are they going to live? Are they going to die? Can they live this way for another 10 years while they're waiting for a transplant?
Yeah.
There's no conclusion. There's no way to have any closure with that because they just don't know. They really have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there are some cancers that are supposedly good cancers where they're treatable and there's others that aren't. But
the research is getting better all the time. And thank God it is. That's why being at a place like Akron Children's, even though my son was so sick, it was very difficult. He was his kidney bed, they called it. They had a couple beds for kids with dialysis and kidney problems on the oncology unit. Mm-hmm. But we also got to be there and watch babies have cancer for 3 months. Mm-hmm. Now, thank God, Akron Children's has a very good survival rate. Not as good as St. Jude's, but about 98%.
Well, Teresa, thank you so much again for a very wonderful, very engaging conversation. I wish you well in your future endeavors, and I will be rooting from you from upstate New York that Kaylee's Legacy and your Facebook group takes traction, creates awareness about the need for mental health resources for transplant recipients. I will be cheering you from this part of the country.
Thank you. And maybe after I get this going, I can come back again and we can talk some more.
Yeah, we can do that. We can maybe look at a follow-up episode a few months down the road and see how things are progressing with the movement. So, again, thank you so much for your time, for your heart, and for sharing your son with us today.
Oh, thank you, Dave. Wait, I got to just show you. This is my beautiful, wonderful, sweet, amazing boy.
And he is a very handsome young man.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.
Thanks again, Dave.